Any other stories or incidents that you recall from the retreat?
I remember being sent to liaise with a infantry brigade in order to bring information back. I can remember having been taught before the war that there were two kinds of infantry brigadier. There's the one who sits behind the hill and you're able to communicate with the rest of the army. There's the one who's on the front of the hill who knows what's going on in the battle, but nobody can really. And this was the brigadier of the kind who sat behind the hill. You could communicate with him, but he didn't really understand what was going on with his soldiers on the other side of the hill.
And you know which brigade it was?
I've forgotten. It was a territorial brigade from Lancashire. I don't know, 134, or that's not the number, but it was a unit of Lancashire type. I can remember the brigadier showing me a piece of paper that had come from one of the units, which was meaningless to him as it was to me, but it was difficult to know what was happening. At the time where I came to leave the brigade headquarters to return to my own, I did not enjoy the use of motorcycles. And I had this rather heavy 500cc Norton, and I had great difficulty in getting the bloody thing to start. It was a kickstart, and there were shells, light mortar shells, coming down in the village at the time, which made it even more necessary to get the thing to start. I can remember being glad when it did start and getting away from the headquarters. That was a personal minor episode in the... I can remember on one of the river crossings, you had to make sure that you got across the river before they blew the bridges, if you see what I mean. And I can remember being engaged in this activity, and there was three vehicles of one of the guards' units, and the sergeant in charge of the came across and saluted with great smartness, asking permission to use your map, sir, which I thought was carrying things a bit far, but we were able to show him where we were and where we were going. These are all the complications and problems of war with movement.
Was fatigue a problem? Did you get enough chance to sleep?
I mentioned that there was an occasion on which one of the guns fell through a culvert, and I remember saying to the soldiers they would have to dismantle so-and-so and get it directed, and went back to my vehicle where I fell fast asleep. And when the soldier came to tell me, I was amazed that they had got it all together and we were now ready to move again. And I was certainly fatigued, and certainly there were other occasions, like had happened on the manoeuvres before the war, where you would wake up and not really remember correctly what had happened before. Yes, a certain good deal of fatigue and the movement. I was on a tower in Mount Kemmel as an observation post, and there was also an observation post of another artillery unit, a field artillery unit, using another part of the same tower. And he told, the officer of that unit told me that the army was about to evacuate itself through Dunkirk, and I had the utmost difficulty in believing that this could be true.
Now, tell me about that OP on Mount Kemmel. What exactly were you doing? I mean, can you describe the operation of an OP?
I was sent there to observe, and therefore it was my job with the radio to report anything which I felt the unit would need to know about. I don't actually remember seeing anything that was of earth-shattering importance. I think I had left the post before the Germans got too near. I went up a number of church towers. Sometimes the churches had already suffered damage from bombs or shells. The place was the civilians had gone, although there might be one or two civilians hiding around the houses out of sight almost. But that was the situation in
So it sounds like, I mean, you weren't there as a classic OP to open fire and direct the fight. Well, you were there more to report what was happening.
Not with 8-inch howitzers and 6-inch guns. The task of 8-inch howitzers and 6-inch guns is to put a great deal of lump of explosion down in a particular place, and you're not very likely to be doing that observed. One of my batteries in my regiment did open fire when a passing padre had pointed out that there were vehicles going into a wood that was in sight, but that was not in my knowledge. My knowledge, we were firing at particular locations on the map when required.
Now, what else do you remember as you fell back?
I'd been told by this other subaltern that we were going to evacuate through Dunkirk, and next day I was told this was so. We got our guns and vehicles to within, some miles from Dunkirk, where we abandoned the vehicles. And
now, tell me about that. Were they properly destroyed? And
yes, the vehicles, I think, were reused to move infantry, but the guns were not destroyed. The breech mechanisms were buried 5 miles away from the guns. So that it was unlikely that they would fetch up together. We were told that we would evacuate through Dunkirk, and the instructions were that we were to go in twos and threes so as not to encourage the passing aeroplanes to strafe us. And so we walked in twos and threes, and on that route I remember there were various episodes where German aeroplanes came over to carry out bombing raids, and one watched them as they went by. And eventually I got myself to Dunkirk, and I was directed along a pier that had already had a shell or bomb damage, and I got onto a destroyer, the Codrington.
So you were evacuated immediately? There was no waiting about?
No waiting about, no, just went, walked. There was a thunderstorm, which also deterred the enemy aircraft for a while. There were aircraft around, but I and two or three other soldiers, by then, we walked into Dunkirk. We found a sailor who told us where to go, and we walked along the quay, and we walked straight onto the destroyer, the Codrington, and we were taken. I was separated from the soldiers and sent down to the wardroom, where I found that there were 20 or 30 other officers. It was very crowded, and there was a mess steward who spent his time waking us up in turn, feeding us the whiskey and the sandwich, that was the way we spent our time until we found ourselves in Dover.
Now, do you know the date you were evacuated from?
No, I don't.
Would it be into June or would it be in May?
Those papers on the table, I expect, will have all that information in there. There will all be all the details as to where I was. We'll look for it and find it for you tomorrow.
And how did you feel about the evacuation and about the general? I mean, the defeat of Gort's army.
I don't know that I was. I was taking it as this was what I was doing, and there was no particular anxiety or what's. I'm sure there was anxiety, but there was no particular reaction to it. It was just taken. That was what was happening. So what? I mean, let's get on with it. I think. The Codrington that I came back on was hit by bombs 2 or 3 days later and beached in Dover. There had already been ships sunk in the harbour at Dunkirk, so that one was aware that there had been a lot of problems. It was not.
Now, what happened when you got back then? You arrived and you'd not been travelling as a unit.
No, not as a unit. We were just we've been told that we must separate ourselves out, so that we were not. I got to Dover, we put on a train, and I remember the WVS or whatever they called themselves in those days, giving us an apple or something to eat and drink. We got on the train. The train took us to some camp, not very sure where, probably Aldershot Way, where we were collected, and then we were sorted out into our various arms, and I was then sent to the Royal Artillery Mess in Woolwich, which I had known before the war, and I spent some days there, getting used to being alive and so forth. And then we were reformed as an artillery unit on in Salisbury Plain, and we caught a train, a special train for the 1st Heavy Regiment Artillery. We did not know where the train was going, and the colonel asked the engine driver, and the engine driver said he was taking it as far as Leicester. Had you been on the Midland main line, you would have stopped at Market Harborough, which is where the train went to, and we got out of the train at Market Harborough and into Billets, where we settled down into the role of anti-parachute. We were given a number of...
Before we go into the actual role, can I just ask you what state the unit was in as a unit when you got there?
It was pretty complete. We had lost a number of soldiers. The only officer casualty that we had, strangely, was our quartermaster. Quartermasters usually survive, and the only one officer that we lost was a quartermaster. We lost a number of NCOs and men, usually because they had been in a vehicle that had been hit by something. But in my own battery, we had... In my own battery, yes, there was one man who was lost somewhere in Dunkirk. I remember we had a court of inquiry to see if we could find out what had happened to him, that he must have been killed in some way in Dunkirk. But I don't think we found out why.
Had it affected the overall morale of the unit, would you say?
Well, obviously we were reacting to that, but it was still part of the job. There was nothing which said give up, or we were... No, I think we were reasonably positive.
What about this anti-parachute? You presumably, firstly, you didn't have your guns anymore.
No, we had no guns. And at this stage, we had Bren guns. We were given a number of civilian coaches and civilian coach drivers. And the task was, if German parachutists, we were to deal with German parachutists before they could be established.
So you were actually... It was an infantry role.
It would be, yes, I suppose that's right. The episode I remember clearest, I remember I told you that I was in the habit of going up church towers, and so confronted with the problem of setting up observation of a large area of Leicestershire, I saw there was a church tower, so I politely said to the vicar that I wanted to go up his church tower to see what the view was like from the point of view of watching German parachutists, and he was appalled at the thought that a church should be used for military purposes, so we spent some time debating the wisdom or ethical considerations, which had not occurred to me before when I had been using churches in France. How I said I wanted to see the view, so I went into the church tower and found that once you got to the bell-ringing floor, from then on you were onto a ladder, which you went up to the next flight and then pulled the ladder up... and moved it on till you could get through the hatch on the top of the church tower, which was obvious to me that there was no way that this was going to be used by me. So I came down again and thanked the vicar, and we didn't trouble the use of his church tower for military purposes. It was quite unsuitable. But
did you have any exercises to sort of test your role?
We did a minor test in order to make sure that... people realise that when you get out of a bus, it's important to get out the Bren guns first, and things of that sort. But no great. And we also got ourselves to know the people in Market Harborough, we quickly got to know, as you may suppose, the factory in Market Harborough. It's a company, a family business. Part of the factory business was the Symington Soups. They made soups, and another part of the same firm made corsets. I gathered that the requirements of workforce is different at different times of year. And so we...
How did you get on with the local population?
Oh, very easily. I remember, however, having occasion to deal with a policeman who was engaged, an inspector, and I can't remember what the occasion was, but I can remember that he had a strongly developed Lancashire accent, and I found that I was reproducing his strong Lancashire accent, and I realised I had better stop this because he might think I was taking the mickey. What we were talking about, or obviously it was something of consequence, but I can't think what.
There was no trouble with the men in the town.
They were happy there, and as I say, we made contact with the workforce, the large female workforce in Melton Mowbray, in Market Harborough, wrong.
So what happened next, and how long were you there?
Well, we went there for more than 10 days, probably, and at that stage it was decided that the regiment would be dispersed, and all the regiment would be scattered around the coast artillery. The coast artillery was the next part of the artillery that was going to be in battle, and our battle experience allegedly was going to be of significance, but also the coast artillery was being expanded.
Now, when did this... This would still be in June, then, presumably? Or would it just edge into July?
I suppose it would be edging into July, yes. As I had not been long... when I got to the Durham Heavy Regiment...
Hang on, so that...
That's where I went to. I went with the Sergeant Major and a number of soldiers to Hartlepool, where the headquarters of the Durham Heavy Brigade, I think it was called at the time, was.
What was their later on? Their number later on?
That was the 511.
511.
Yes, the Durham Heavy Regiment became 511 and 526. They were the two regiments that formed out of. We could place my arrival fairly accurately because about 3 days before I arrived there, the territorial colonel was killed in his car. He had gone down to look at the new batteries that were forming part of his command in Scarborough and Whitby, and he had an accident, a road accident, and got killed. And since he hadn't told anybody where he was going, it was some 3 days before the people in Hartlepool knew what had become of him. And that happened just before I got there. This was the early days of the creation of the two coast artillery regiments out of what had been the fixed defence headquarters, the Durham Heavy Brigade, RATA. And again, rather like on mobilisation, there were officers and men arriving and being sorted. There was a training battery that was training men for these emergency batteries that were being created around the coast of Britain. Wherever there was a landing beach, there would be guns sighted to cover it, and the guns would be coast artillery, would be from the naval service, so they would be naval guns, not the land service field equipment. And there was a Captain Russell in charge of the training battery who was training and recreating these units. And I can remember one of the men that turned up without expectation. There was no knowledge he was coming. I think his name was Day. He was, I'm pretty sure, a fifth columnist who had arrived to court to cause alarm and concern.
Now, what makes you think that? Tell us as much as you remember about it, because that's very unusual.
This chap was in Hartlepool in the mess, and they did not know he was coming, and he had nothing to prove why he was there. And he was sort of pointing out that everything was in confusion, and he tried to get me to talk about my experiences in France in a negative way, suggesting that all was confusion and chaos, which I did not do. And I discovered that he had subsequently been removed. I think he was almost certainly some form of... the fifth columnist who was trying to spread alarm and concern.
Did you actually report him yourself? Or?
Well, no, I was, remember, just the newly appointed, recently arrived. I mean, this was, there were men much more senior and experienced than I around.
Now, what about the composition of, well, 511 Regiment, the regiment, one of the two regiments that was being formed? What was the composition of it?
The organisation, before the war, there was a 6-inch battery at Hartlepool, a 6-inch battery at Seaton Carew, and a 9.2-inch single gun at Pasley, and these were the defences of the River Tees. When the emergency was taking place, there were extra batteries created, and so 511 Regiment comprised the 6-inch batteries at Hartlepool. It comprised a 12-pounder battery on Old Pier, which was a battery that had existed in the First War and had been demounted, and there was another 6-inch naval emergency battery at Seaton Carew to deal with the landing beaches on that side.
Can you describe those batteries in any more detail? You know, the actual setup of each one of them.
The actual
setup of each battery. You know, how many guns and what the placements were like.
The Hartlepool battery. There was 3 6-inch Mark II mountings. And they had been there since the early part of the century, 1906 or thereabouts, and they had been the guns that had been in action in 1914 with the German battlecruisers. The 2 12-pounders on the Old Pier, which had been dismounted and were in the process of being re-erected when I arrived, and the battery at Seaton Carew was 2 6-inch naval mounting, one of these emergency batteries that had been set up. I was saying that we had this training unit that was setting up, and there were similarly, there were the batteries at Scarborough and Whitby, and that were the batteries that the 511 Regiment had, the 3 batteries of Seaton Carew, Old Pier and Yuff. H-E-U-G-H, the Hartlepool. The Hartlepool, there were 3 guns, one of which was called Lighthouse, and the other 2 were called Huff. And at an earlier stage, they had been separate. But by the time 1938 arrived, it was one battery. If you were to read the history books of the engagement in 1914, you'll find that the Lighthouse gun does this, and the Huff battery does that. And indeed, part of the difficulty of the Lighthouse gun was that the Lighthouse got in the way, which was why the Lighthouse was knocked down and resighted behind the 6-inch gun. But
Now, what were your first impressions of the unit when you joined it, other than that they had a fifth columnist?
Well, there was one had to adjust to the thought that these were territorials, and territorials are not the same as regulars.
In what way? Just take me through the qualities of each, or the problems.
The territorials have different experience, and they don't they aren't so narrowly the same. My regimental commander, he became, when I first arrived, he was the officer commanding the Yuff battery. He was a civilian employed in Cheshire as a prosecuting solicitor. Clearly he didn't talk in the same way, behave in the same way as the majors that I had been accustomed to, who were liable to talk of India or wherever else, regular like subjects. He had different topics of conversation, but they were different. I remember I had barely arrived there, but one of the young officers of the regiment urged me to take the place that he was being given. He was being sent to the Coast Battery that was to be in Tobruk, and he had a wife and children in Hartlepool, and it would be better for him to be in the Hartlepool Battery, he thought. But as far as I was concerned, this was no consideration for me, and I barely understood too much about Coast Artillery, and was busily reading Coast Artillery Training Vol. 1 and the manuals that went with the gun. which were so different to 8-inch howitzers. And I remember after I, a day or two after I had been appointed as the battery commander of the 12-pounder guns.
That's on the old pier.
On the old pier, a sapper. In those days, the sappers were closely involved with the artillery. They ran the searchlights. The sapper captain told me that my searchlights would be in action in 2 days' time. At that stage, I didn't know I had any searchlights, but it came as an interesting surprise. But,
now, what about what were you learning about the gunnery? Was it mainly the guns? And the was this?
Well, everything one had to learn was the role, the relationship with the Navy, the relationship with the naval organisation at the inshore side. We had communications of various sorts to relate to the control of shipping coming in. The whole thing was a new ball game. I can remember that I had not long been in command of Old Pier when we had a visit from the Inspector of Fixed Defences, who asked me had I had any professional training, and I told him, "Oh yes, sir. I went on the course at Larkhill, the 3-week young officers course at Larkhill," which was a tongue-in-cheek, and of course, nothing to do with it. So it was not very long after that before I was sent to the Coast Artillery School to be taught something more about Coast Artillery guns. In the field, in the anti-motor torpedo boat role of a 12-pounder, the gun is controlled and commanded by the sergeant in charge of it. There is no overall command from the officer other than engage, so there was not too much to learn on that.
What did you think of the 12-inch, the 12-pounder? Sorry, not 12-inch.
12-pounder. Well, I admit the handbook that I was using was dated 1914, and I found when I read my way through it that the ammunition with the a direct action fuse was described as obsolescent. It was still, of course, the equipment that I was being supplied with in 1940, which was not too encouraging. But
how many guns were there?
There were 2 12-pounders on the pier, and there were 2 searchlights.
And were they protected in any way, or were they just open on the pier?
They were open on the pier, but of course the gun itself has a substantial shield around it, but there was nothing, no protection behind.
Where was your command position or command post?
On the lighthouse above it, which was a wooden structure, so it was not very protected.
So what did you have in the command post? Do you see what I mean? What exactly?
A telephone. That was all. There was not. You had your eyes. You could see the, and you had a telephone communication to the fire control people. And you had
that's down on the pier then.
No, at a distance, the fire commander who would be in charge of all the batteries in that part of the scene.
So there'd just be you and a signaller
On duty at a time. That's right. That would be. And indeed, when I was doing duty, I would be asleep on the end of the pier, along able to control the guns if required down below.